It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. He was the closer, the finisher, the pitcher the Pirates counted on in the late innings when the game got tight and the Bucks needed someone to save the day. In fact, Kenta Colvey, with his trademark sidearm delivery, finished his illustrious big league baseball career with 184 saves, none bigger than the one in Game 7 of the 1979 World Series versus the Baltimore Orioles. Later in the program, before we wrap it up, we'll talk to you about a professional ultimate league, ultimate frisbee, as we used to call it. Now it's referred to as an ultimate disc league. It is a professional league, and we'll talk with the player, one of the players, and the coach of the new Pittsburgh Thunderbirds coming to Pittsburgh, and we'll talk about that before the show is over. In fact, we may just have those folks on a little bit earlier while we make the effort to get Kenta Colvey to rejoin us by phone. Right now, we're joined by a couple members of the Pittsburgh Thunderbirds. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having us.
With me now here in our new Community Broadcast Center studio is the coach of the Pittsburgh Thunderbirds, Dave Hogan, along with player Aaron Watson. The team began its inaugural season earlier this month and will play 7 home games in Pittsburgh before they take to the field this weekend for their home opener. And this is something that a lot of people probably aren't even aware exists. Ultimate Disc League. What is that? What is that exactly? Explain what this league is all about and how a professional league came into being. Let's start with the coach here, Dave Hogan.
So the AUDL, which is the professional league that we're in, has, I think, 25 or so teams around the country. Our specific region, we're in the Midwest division, so we just play Detroit, Madison, Minneapolis, Chicago, Indianapolis, and Cincinnati. So we just play our regional games. There's also an East division with teams like New York and D.C. and Philly. There's a South division with like Atlanta and Raleigh. There's a Western division, which is California, Washington, and British Columbia. Vancouver's got a team. So we play one game or maybe two games a weekend. So, for example, this coming weekend, Cincinnati's coming here to play us. Next weekend, we'll travel to play Madison on Saturday and Minneapolis on Sunday. But it's one game at a time. It's about a two-and-a-half-hour game. And we play 14 of them during the regular season.
And I mean, we used to refer to this as Ultimate Frisbee. When did it become Ultimate Disc?
I think it's just the league's decision to have that kind of abbreviation, but most people just call it ultimate because, you know, brevity is the soul of wit. So why use more syllables than you need to?
But it's basically the same game.
It's the same sport. The pro leagues have some nuances. Typically the games are actually played to a point. So usually you'll play your game to 15 or 17. The first team to score that many points wins. In this league, it's 4 timed quarters to better reflect like basketball or other professional sports. So you'll play 4 12-minute quarters, and whoever has the most points out at the end of that has won. And in addition to that, the field is also larger. It's 13 yards wider and 10 yards longer to completely fit onto a football field. Usually it's played on a little bit smaller of a playing surface than that.
And the games will be played where again?
We have, I believe, 5 home games at Couples Stadium on Southside. That's right on like East Carson.
That's just down the street from where we are.
Perfectly convenient. Saturday nights, it's a great opportunity to go out and watch that. The atmosphere is really good. The stadium itself has a very nice. The field is very good. The surrounding environment is very unique and very Pittsburgh. You know, you're playing in a hollow with a hill right next to you, and trains driving by, and like to see that. Is just, yeah, I'm in Pittsburgh. This is wonderful. You get that home feel. Like, you don't have the skyline of Pittsburgh, but there's no mistaking you're in Pittsburgh when you see that.
And this is, Couples Stadium is primarily for high school events. So can you sell beer there?
I don't believe we can.
There won't be any beer at Couples Stadium, but we strongly encourage people to go enjoy themselves, maybe before on Carson Street, maybe after, make a night of it.
Because that's a big drawing. I mean, let's face it, we're in Pittsburgh, and that's just part of the whole feeling of going to a sporting event, right?
Oh, there's absolutely no argument here. I trust that Pittsburgh has the ability to tailgate well and have a good time afterwards. We do have 2 games at Founders Field in Cheswick, which I believe is a rugby field complex, and their alcohol is sold. So That's your opportunity for that one.
And there's definitely going to be some tailgating going on before the game tomorrow. I know that's happening.
That's very cool. Now, I'm curious how Aaron Watson was the guy that you just last heard. He is a player for the team. How did you get involved as a – how do you become a professional ultimate disc player?
Well, I'm guilty of playing just about every sport that's been out there, football, soccer, everything you can imagine. One of my buddies just started throwing a Frisbee at me back in high school. You know, came to a couple games, got hooked – just on the athleticism, the speed of the game, it's really fast paced. And getting to, you know, just be speeding, speeding around. The way the disc travels is really different than a lot of other sports out there. So with a baseball or a football, you're following a very linear arc of the way the ball travels. But with the disc, you can bend it, it's affected by the wind. So you really have to be using your brain while simultaneously running at full speed, which is really, really addicting. And kept playing at Pitt, won 2 national championships there. A lot of former Pitt guys, along with guys from CMU, Edinburgh, Ohio, Penn State, Dayton, suiting up for the Thunderbirds this year. It's a really, really talented team.
And there's a real, I guess, ultimate disc culture in Pittsburgh, right? You mentioned what they have at Pitt. So there's kind of a built-in following because a lot of people here participate in the sport.
Absolutely. The Pittsburgh High School Ultimate League is one of the biggest high school ultimate leagues in the entire country. Pitt is the number one team in the nation this year, a consistent contender for national championships. Just from top to bottom, there's masters leagues that have 40-year-old guys still running around and playing. We've got middle school leagues. There is a amazing ultimate community, and it continues to grow because every new person that comes in has an amazing time, not only enjoying the sport, but enjoying the people that they're spending their time with.
I think what's really, really cool about the community is you'll have myself, who coaches a pro and a college team, and my friend Nick, who also coaches the college team, and we'll also be coaching middle school teams and working at middle school camps over the summer. And it's a really cool community, and it's a very rare thing to have. You'll never have Nick Saban coach Alabama, but also be coaching 10-year-olds at the same time. But we do, and we invest in the community a lot and invest in the youth. And people I coach when they were 14 or 15 are now playing for me at Pitt, and eventually they'll come to play for the pro team in a few years too. So it's really cool to have that continued relationship for a long time.
And you're a professional. Can I ask what a professional ultimate disc player makes?
It's definitely not enough to pay the bills. It's a small $60 game check. Beyond that, I've got a day job.
Yeah, I was going to say. So the bottom line is hang on to your day job.
for the time being.
But have fun. It's the Pittsburgh Thunderbirds, and they are playing Cincinnati in their inaugural home game as members of the American Ultimate Disc League. That's at Couples Stadium tomorrow night.
Yep.
And we've been talking here with the coach, Dave Hogan, and player, Aaron Watson. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yep, thanks a lot for having us.
Coming up later in the program, we will have, as promised, former Pirates pitcher Kent Tekulve. But coming up next, a look at the impact of StoryCorps' new mobile recording app on people creating their own audio histories. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Since 2003, StoryCorps has been carrying on the long tradition of oral history in America by enabling people to record their own stories and make those stories available on the StoryCorps website as well as within the Library of Congress. Selected stories are also broadcast on NPR's Morning Edition. Recently, StoryCorps, which traditionally records interviews in 3 story booths and 2 mobile booths, made the choice to expand the possibilities for recording by creating a mobile app. Joining us to talk about the new StoryCorps app are Greg Gibalisco of Maya Design, the firm that designed the app. Greg Gibalisco, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thank you.
Also with us, Dean Haddock, who is Director of Web and Information Technology for StoryCorps. He joins us by phone from Brooklyn, New York. Hello, Dean.
Hello. How are you doing?
Well, thank you. Where did the idea for this app come from?
It started out of the National Day of Listening project, which we began several years ago, and we asked the country to, on the day after Thanksgiving, instead of, you know, going shopping and participating in the Black Friday madness, to sit down with a friend or a loved one and have an intimate conversation as the most valuable but least expensive gift that we can give each other.
What a concept.
So it's kind of, yeah, it's, and it, it, you know, everybody would give us feedback saying, oh, you know, it'd be great to have a place to upload these. So we built that and sort of prototyped that out over the last few years. And when our founder, Dave Isay, and StoryCorps won the TED Prize this year, it was pretty obvious what we were going to do. And that's how we ended up building this app.
And in what ways was it intended, Dean, to extend the goal of StoryCorps?
StoryCorps has basically two sides of its mission, two aspects of its mission. So one is to provide access to this experience of having a conversation, having it documented and archived at the Library of Congress. The other half of that mission is to provide access to these stories and to the content. So StoryCorps' traditional model interview is about 40 minutes long, and you go into a booth, a recording booth. There's one in New York, there's one in San Francisco, another in Chicago, and another in Atlanta. And then we have a mobile Airstream recording unit that's going around the country as well, collecting stories all the time. So that's a 40-minute conversation recorded on really high-fidelity audio equipment. And it's archived by professional archivists, which we call facilitators, who are specially trained to deal with sensitive populations, as well as, you know, follow best practices in terms of audio engineering and archival practices. The StoryCorps app experience is much less attended, much less hands-on. And instead of editing these down, we just allow them to be out there on the Internet as part of a full public archive that people can, you know, explore and experiment with on their own.
And Greg, your firm, Maya Design, was mm-hmm. ultimately chosen to create the app. What was it about Maya or its approach that made it the logical choice?
Our approach was to take a human-centered approach, so to put people at the center of the process and not just lead with technology. Creating an app that just records is pretty easy, but creating an app that lets technology disappear into the background and let people have a conversation with one another, that's really hard to do. And we learned that early on once we actually started this project. We failed a couple of times with some early prototypes before we got it right.
And so, Dean, what was it about the app that Maya created that led you to say, yeah, this is how we want to do this?
It's a great question, right? So we didn't really know exactly what Maya was going to create until we were at the end of that process. So really, we had to sort of make a strategic gamble on a particular organization in a very quick turnaround, because we, you know, we got the news of the TED Prize around October of last year and needed to be teed up to start moving forward on January 1 of this year, and then releasing the app by March 15th, or I think it was March 17th, which is when Dave Isay did his TED Talk. So the reason we felt extremely comfortable going with Maya was, one, that I had spent a little bit of time with Maya through the Knight Foundation, through their prototype award. Maya's got another company called Luma, heavily associated with them, that sort of teaches this design methodology. It teaches the process, and that process came directly out of Maya. So what I knew was, since we were embarking on territory that we've never been in before and we needed to move really quickly, it was less important to know exactly what the product was going to look like and get some kind of, I don't know, premonition or some kind of clue on that from a designer. What we really needed to know was the process going into it, and whether that process would work for StoryCorps, because We're incredibly democratic. We've got a lot of brilliant people in our ranks. We have about 100 staff, and all of them have some input or some, you know, creative thoughts on the interview process itself. Maya's process, the process that Greg led us through specifically, helped us get all those ideas out and make strategic decisions and pick, you know, the low and the high hanging fruit that we were going to pursue during that really, really fast build sprint.
And the app actually archives every interview that is recorded. How does that work? I would think that would be a tremendous amount of material.
It's quite a bit. The app connects with an API that exists on some server infrastructure on the web. So the interviews are recorded, captured, collected through the app, if you will, and then they're pushed to kind of a central repository.
That's right. Yeah. So it's important to note that this isn't just an app. It's a platform. So there's an app that gives access to anybody who wants to create a StoryCorps interview, has the courage to do an interview with somebody, and has a smartphone, Android or iPhone. But there's also an API that it's open source, and there's a website component to this as well that has a much richer browsing experience. It's the three of those things together that ultimately provide this larger platform.
And it enables people to access this in a very different way. They don't have to go to one of the mobile booths. They don't have to go to one of the story booths. They can maybe get more out of it because they're in a more intimate setting, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I think there's a trade-off. Right. Greg, go ahead and speak to that, because you and Greg, maybe you can share a little bit about your interview experience, because you've done both the in-the-booth experience and the DIY app experience.
That would be really the only way to fully understand what you're creating is to actually engage in the experience yourself, right?
Yeah. So, you know, the term we use for that is a walk-a-mile. So put yourself in the shoes of the user. And one of the first things we did when we kicked this project off, myself, Francine Gemperly, and John Larkin, two of my other colleagues, is we sat down for a traditional StoryCorps interview in Manhattan in the sound booth, which looks a lot like this sound booth, right? The big microphones in front of you, a very quiet setting, state-of-the-art recording facility, and a professional facilitator right there. And what we wanted to create was a piece of technology that acts as the digital facilitator. But there's still a lot that goes into it, and I think we have a long way to go to get those production values up to where they're even remotely close to the traditional interview. But part of it is, you know, coaching people along the way. People don't want it when they download an app. The first thing they don't want to do is read through a user's manual. Mm-hmm. So in the app there are little opportunities, little moments where we give people a little bit of coaching. And they can dismiss that and go on. They could just go in and just make a recording right away. But there is – StoryCorps has been doing this for a long time, and they have a body of knowledge that they can pass on about what makes a good interview, what makes a good facilitator, what questions will elicit a really great, kind of compelling, meaningful interview. You have to remember that this isn't just about a coffee table conversation. This is about a meaningful conversation between two people that could be a much more profound conversation. Some of our
conversation that they might not have otherwise.
That they might not have otherwise. A lot of the early interviews that we did with people around StoryCorps, Dean was one of them. The thing that we kept hearing is that it's almost like a transformational experience. When you go into this, you come out and you're a little bit different. You have a bit more empathy for the person that you've been talking to, and it's an opportunity for two people to connect. And we wanted to make sure that the technology didn't get in the way of that.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about the new StoryCorps app, which was designed by Greg Gibalisco of Maya Design, the firm that designed the app, as I said. And Dean Haddock is with us by phone from Brooklyn. He's the Director of Web and Information Technology for StoryCorps. What do you think the ultimate impact of this app will be, and how will it change StoryCorps?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the easiest question or the easier part of that question is, what's the potential of this app, like where it's going? And since we launched it as part of the formative for StoryCorps because we're traditionally, we've only served the United States. We have done a couple of projects here and there with like the BBC and so forth, but we haven't opened up a booth or done interviews in other countries before. So first and foremost is, you know, we're implicitly global at this point, so we've got to adjust to that really quickly. We're also not really a tech company at this point. Well, we're not like a technology Silicon Valley company. We're digital and we're innovative, but we don't, for instance, have an army of developers or support staff working on this kind of project. So we have to internally ask ourselves some difficult questions and really think about strategically, like, oh, now that we have this product out in the market, like, what does year two and year three look like? And so we're having conversations about that now. And we've been having conversations about that for a while. But now that we've sort of demonstrated some degree of success with the app, I think there's more buy-in, both from our funders, our supporters out there in the world, and also internal staff and the board to really kind of, like, take this as far as we can. I think that it ultimately is going to increase our access. StoryCorps has recorded about 65,000 interviews in its lifetime of about 11 years. And in just the first month of this app, we've recorded almost a couple of thousand interviews. So, you know, since we're used to doing about 5,000 interviews per year, this could potentially make our uptake in interview collection very, very high. Fortunately, we built the API and the platform with that in mind, so it should scale very efficiently. But I think it also, there's an opportunity here to really elevate the dialogue, the global dialogue that's happening right now about, you know, various political issues, health issues, economic issues, and all of this stuff. And it gives people, I think, a place of record to come together and talk about those issues or just to talk about their lives and what their experience as a human on this planet might be like for future generations.
And I guess here's the big question, fellas, and that would be, why do these voices and interviews matter? In an age of Twitter, Facebook, mm-hmm. BuzzFeed, all these other media sources, everybody has access to a video recording device of one kind or another. What is it about audio recording that remains special?
You know, for me, early on in some of the discovery that we were doing on this project, we thought about, you know, do we allow video? Is there, you know, when we thought about the potential of this, archiving the wisdom of humanity and capturing these stories, the potential is almost unlimited. And what we learned from some of the conversations with StoryCorps and the team is what makes a StoryCorps interview a StoryCorps interview.
And you're saying you were considering video?
So we were considering the full gamut of things. I mean, early on in a design process, you don't want to make assumptions about what this is. You at least want to explore a range of options and then have some kind of metric to say, well, what is the best thing to move forward? So we were considering video. We were considering photography. This was at Maya Design before we started really kind of digging into this project. And the interesting thing is, when people are on video, they act differently. And when you get two people in a quiet, intimate space together, and there's a recording device, but they're really just they're connecting and having a conversation, and they're not worried about the media, they're able to have a much more of a connection in that kind of conversation. But I want to talk about a couple of other things too, because I think that let's think about the experiences that this platform affords people to have. And I think there's kind of three experiences. And the one is the experience that I get really excited about, which is like, I personally can archive my family and my close friends. So my son could interview, his grandparents, and then he could have that, you know, years from now, he could go back to that and listen to that. And I think that's really powerful.
And
I think
his children could too.
And his children could, and people can get really excited about that. But if you go a layer outside of that, people can interview when you have access to this kind of technology, and you can create these interviews, and you have a platform to share it where people can start to browse it later. I think it allows you to do things that maybe StoryCorps didn't even plan for. So as a design student, I might go out and interview all of the design heroes that I might have access to or be able to get access to now, and now I have that. And that's another layer. And then I think outside of that, there's the browsing experience that right now for StoryCorps doesn't exist. And so that's, if I'm interested in World War II and I want to hear a firsthand perspective from somebody who was there, I could browse for that and I could find and discover those things. And I think that's really powerful. So when we talk about the kinds of experiences that are now even possible with this, there are several different kinds of experiences that this allows people to have.
It's interesting to hear that Maya was considering video. I remember actually when that got brought up in our initial brainstorm sesh, because StoryCorps is strictly an audio program. It's an audio project. And I think the way that we see it is, well, our founder, for instance, came from documentary radio production. There's something different about experiencing the voice over audio without the distraction of the video as well. And when we hear a human voice, even on the phone, but basically the higher fidelity, the better, it affects the brain in a different way, I would presume, than, and I'm not a neurologist or a neuroscientist by any stretch of the imagination, but I think there's really something special and profound that happens in the act of attentive listening. As your radio audience, could probably agree to, there's also, the added benefit of being able to listen to audio and recapture some time. So we listen to podcasts on our commute. We can listen to StoryCorps on our commute. You can be doing something else while you're listening to the radio or while you're listening to audio. And with such a treasure trove of audio, I mean, the collection of StoryCorps, may very well be endless at this point now that we have this app. There's no possible way that one person could listen to all of the content in their lifetime. So I think there's also something special about the way we consume audio. And now with ubiquity of mobile devices, et cetera, it's just going to be easier and easier.
We've been talking about the new StoryCorps mobile app. Our guest in studio has been Greg Gibalisco of Maya Design, also with us, Dean Haddock, joining us by phone from Brooklyn. He is Director of Web and Information Technology for StoryCorps. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today on Essential Pittsburgh and sharing this information. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Last fall, former Pirates relief pitcher Kent DeColvey appreciated the biggest save of his life when he received a heart transplant at Allegheny General Hospital. It not only saved his life, but altered the way he looks at it. And after missing the end of last season, Teak, as he is known, returned to his job as a post-game analyst on Pirates telecasts, and he joins us now by phone. Kent DeColvey, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, Paul. How are you doing today?
I'm well, thank you. How are you? How is your health, and how are you feeling, Kent?
I'm about better than I have been in the last 10 years. It's real a real simple way to put it. I had a heart attack back in 2001, and from that point on, my heart had continued to deteriorate. Once there's damage done to the heart, it's very difficult to maintain the level that you have, and it just kind of continually slips down the slope. And over a 12-year period, I'm just sitting there thinking, well, boy, I'm getting old in a hurry. Things aren't as easy as they used to be and everything else. And then all of a sudden we found out why I was getting old in a hurry. My heart was giving out on me, and finally, back Christmas Eve in 2013, it said, you know what, I give. The old no moss thing on me. So I had a pump implanted at that point in time, and about 9 months later, was fortunate enough to be able to get a heart transplant September 5th of last year. And since that time, it's just been absolutely amazing to me the difference in my life, the way I feel, even my ability to rationally think had diminished, because of the slower, less blood flow that I had going to all the organs in my body, including the brain. So I'm a very fortunate person now to be able to sit here and tell you that I feel like I did it 8 or 10 years ago, and it's just basically one of those gifts that you get that you never do anything for. You just get this gift, and it gives you an ability to go ahead and continue your life beyond where you were normally going to be, and hopefully during that period of time that I've been given, I'll be able to, try to accomplish some more to leave this place, I guess, is one of my goals in life, leave this place a little better than I found it when I entered it in 1947. So I take this as an opportunity to continue to do that.
And you have encouraged people to be organ donors.
Yeah, it's, it's something you think about every time you go get your driver's license. Oh, do you want to be an organ donor? Oh, yeah, I'll be an organ donor. It's kind of an afterthought, or, you've heard somebody say something about, a situation that somebody was in, and this didn't, because they were an organ donor, they didn't feel like they were treated fairly, or whatever it is. And it's just kind of a casual thing that you do. And during this whole process of what I went through, what I found out was we here in Western Pennsylvania are extremely, extremely fortunate to have two facilities that are just, the technology that they both have and the abilities that they have to do things like this are tremendous. And, we are fortunate to have that kind of care in our area, and the doctors and the surgeons that are involved in these things, as good as there are anywhere. And yet, with all of that, they can't do a darn thing to help anybody unless there's an organ being donated that they can transplant into another person. So, like I said, we're fortunate what we have facility-wise and talent-wise between the hospitals and the doctors. But it still takes us to make that miracle happen. It takes somebody that's willing to be an organ donor, willing to sign up to be an organ donor, and make a difference. I try to think about it, and I've been signed up as an organ donor for years. It's like the last gift that you get to give in your life is actually the gift of life to someone else. And you start thinking about that a little bit, and that's pretty dramatic.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, my guest, former Pirates pitcher and current TV analyst Kent Tucholvy, joining us by phone. And Kent, we have a clip from the 1979 World Series, and for folks who didn't hear it earlier, we wanted to play this and kind of relive some of the memories going back to 1979 when you saved Game 7 of the 1979 World Series versus the Baltimore Orioles.
A classic seven-game battle of brilliant comebacks by both sides now prepares for the closing curtain. Pittsburgh adds two insurance runs in the top of the ninth, and in the bottom, a weary Tucholvy is one out away from giving Pittsburgh its fifth World Championship. Four to one Pirates. Pop Stargell and company have done it. Only the fifth team in World Series history to come back after being down 3-1. It all tops a fantastic year of baseball. 1979, year of the fan, year of the Oriole, and most of all, year of the family, the world champion Pittsburgh Pirates.
So, Kent, you're hearing Vin Scully narrating the 1979 World Series film, which that clip is from, and he's describing how a weary Tucholvy saved Game 7. How tired were you?
Well, first of all, I never get tired of hearing about that last out in the World Series. That was, that's the goal of every major league player who ever puts on a uniform, is to be in a position to be on a world championship team and to actually be able to be the guy out on the mound when it happens and throw the last pitch. It's just a special, special moment in any baseball player's career. How weary was I? Very weary. The seventh game of the World Series that year was my 101st game that I had pitched in. And I believe I was right around 150 innings for the year, counting, you know, the regular season plus the postseason. So, yeah, over a six-month period, I had gone from not being very, you know, I wasn't exactly the physical fitness, the picture of physical fitness, of 6'4" and 155 pounds. But I think I had squeezed every bit out of my body that I had that year to get through that last out. And to be perfectly honest with you, if there had been a game the next day, I don't know if I'd have made it, if I'd have been able to throw again. But, you know, fortunately for myself, fortunately for the ball club, fortunately for all of us, we had Pops around to put the team on his shoulders, and the rest of us were able to straggle to the finish line and just get it done.
You were the master of the 2- and 3-inning save. Whatever happened to that?
The game of baseball changes. We've seen, you know, a whole lot of things that have affected it, but the biggest thing was actually in 1979 when we won the World Series. I finished second in the National League in saves with 31. Bruce Sutter, pitching for the Cubs, finished with 35 and set the new National League mark for saves in a season. Well, Bruce, if you remember, had that split-finger fastball that everybody is now throwing. He was the originator of it. And the reason why he developed that pitch was back in A-ball, he had hurt his arm. And his A-ball pitching coach, a guy by the name of Mike Rourke, had taught him this pitch. And this actually made Suter's entire career because, you know, that was what he needed after he couldn't throw his fastball that hard anymore. He had this split finger that he could throw and get people out. The problem was because his arm was hurt, he could only pitch one inning. So they started using him in the ninth inning, and they had a guy by the name of Dick Tidrow was his setup guy, and he could pitch every day as many innings as you needed. Tidrow was a horse. And so that's how they started doing it. Well, all of a sudden, you know, everybody, baseball's a game of copycat, and you see somebody that's only pitching the ninth inning and he's saving 35 games. That's the way everybody should do it. So the game started changing there, and then as we saw over time, bullpens went from 5 pitchers to nowadays there are 7, which means there are more pitchers on the staff, so you can spread the work out a little more, a little more of the matchup stuff in the early innings. So that was really the time when the game started to change, and the 2- and 3-inning saves, you know, kind of went by the wayside in the favor of having a 1-inning save that you could, and then guys started saving 50, 55, 60 games a year. So, you know, that really was the change in the way bullpens were used and the way, in particular, closers were handled and the way they were used. They became 1-inning pitchers.
Your trademark, Kent, in addition to your dark glasses, was your buggy whip sidearm delivery. How did you learn to pitch that way?
You know, it's funny. I threw sidearm my whole life and was very effective doing it all the way through high school, college, you know, all the way pro ball, actually, all the way up till I was in double A. And we found out that, you know, the hitters were starting to catch on and they were starting to hit it. And there was an old scout in the organization by the name of George Detour. And he came up to me one day and he told me, he says, you know, your ball moves really good when it's just around the strike zone, but when it actually gets in the strike zone itself, it doesn't move as well. And that's what was happening. The hitters were getting better. They were taking the pitches that were off the plate, and they were forcing me to throw more balls over the plate. And I was starting to get hit. So he said, you got to find some way to get that movement in the strike zone. So I tried throwing overhand, and that was an absolute disaster. I was about 82 mile an hour and perfectly straight. That wasn't going to get the job done. So I remembered a guy by the name of Ted Abernathy. He was a journeyman reliever when I grew up. He played with the Reds back in Cincinnati. He played with a bunch of clubs. He played with the Cubs. I think he played with the Braves. And he threw with a submarine delivery. So playing catch out in the outfield one day, I said, let me see what happens if I throw it like Abernathy did. And the first one I threw, the bottom just fell out of it. And I'm going, I think we got something here. So, you know, basically the fastball, the sinker, my staple pitch, it was wired that one day in the outfield. I didn't have to do a whole lot of adjusting or anything else to get it to work. where I had the difficulty was coming up with the breaking ball to complement it from that angle. And it took me about, I'd say, two and a half years to find a way to throw the breaking ball. So I would have that combination of fastball, and I called it a slider. It was probably more of a slurve. You know, to find a way to be able to get that pitch over the plate and be effective with it, so I wasn't throwing just all sinkers. You know, you have to have something to offset it. But that's how I developed the thing. It was actually about a 10-year-old's memory of what some kind of weird, strange pitcher that was pitching for my team, the Cincinnati Reds, at that time. You know, who knows? There might be some kid that was 10 years old when I was pitching that might tell you the same story about where he's at today. But that's how I came up with that delivery.
And you achieved many milestones for durability during the course of your career. In fact, you hold the National League record for career innings pitched in relief, 1,436 and two-thirds innings. Now, a lot of pitchers' arms would have fallen off by then. What made you so resilient?
Well, probably the same thing, you know, that I was able to get the heart transplant and everything else. God has looked down on me a whole lot of times and given me things that he hasn't given to anybody else. And I basically was just given an arm that, you know, that didn't tighten up. That if I threw today, it didn't get tight and sore tomorrow like most guys do. And there were teammates, of course, who, you know, said that I didn't throw hard enough to get hurt. Some of them were saying, you know, that I didn't have any muscles anyway to get tight. There were a lot of things going on in
nice,
the clubhouse.
Nice guys.
In reality, I was just blessed with an arm that you know, could just go back and throw day in and day out and not really have any negative effects from it.
With the career numbers that you've achieved, shouldn't you be in the Hall of Fame, the Baseball Hall of Fame?
No, I don't think so. A lot of people do. I'm very proud of the fact that I was a good player in the major leagues. You know, I was a good player in Pirates history. I was not a Willie Stargell. I was not a Roberto Clemente. I wasn't that type of a player. I'm just very pleased that, you know, with my limited abilities that I had and being able to squeeze as much out of those abilities as I could over the years, that I was able to become a very competitive and a player who could contribute to the club on a, you know, on a pretty regular basis, since I could throw every day. So, but no, when I look at myself, I've never thought of myself as a Hall of Famer. I think I'm just very proud to have been able to do what I was able to do and to compete against a whole lot of Hall of Famers and have some success against them while I was playing.
Before we wrap this up, we've got about a minute or so left, Kent, but Willie Stargell's name has come up a couple times in this conversation. Describe the camaraderie on that We Are Family Pirates team. It wasn't just a slogan, was it? You guys really seemed to live it.
Yeah, it was a situation where in the clubhouse, I mean, you spend so much time together, and, you know, there's going to be friction over the course of a year. Just, you know, you travel, you're on the road together, you're, you know, that team, for some reason, and most of it was kind of, you know, we all watched Willie, and whatever Willie did, we kind of wanted to do things like that, and we learned from him about the way he handled himself. And, you know, he was just the most gracious person I have ever met in my life. Besides being a tremendous Hall of Fame baseball player, he was probably even a better person. And I think the way I can put it best is, and again, we all tried to emulate being like him, he's one of the very few athletes that I've ever been around who's actually better than what his perception was. You know, most of us, we can fool the public a little bit here, a little bit there, or hide something or do something. Willie was exactly as good and probably better than people thought he was. And that I can't say about very many of the players that I played with or against in my entire career, including myself. That, you know, he genuinely was just that good a person.
Kent Okolvi, it is so great to hear how well you're doing and to have had you on Essential Pittsburgh. Continued good health to you, and thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Well, Paul, it's been my pleasure, and thank you very much for having me.
And that will do it for today's edition of Essential Pittsburgh. Monday on the program, we'll talk with Steve Sokol, outgoing president of the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh, and also discover how the Friends of the Old Stone Tavern are attempting to save the oldest commercial building in the region. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Have a great weekend, everybody.